ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Christopher and Pixie Skase flaunted their wealth.
27 white limousines and the champagne flowed.
It couldn't be bigger than Pixie's blonde hair.
Spending other people's money, and when they were found out, Pixie paid the price.
A sort of gilded cage that she was a prisoner in.
I'm Mark Humphreys. To binge the full series now, search for ABC Rewind and look for Skase, Fall of a Tycoon on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Here are three good reasons, very good reasons, why you should encourage your child not to become an academic. One, the world seems to have fallen out of love with experts. They're now treated with suspicion. Two, they won't just be left in peace to study their treasured specific area of academic interest. No, they'll have to work with students. And almost all of those students will be really, really young. And some, objectionable. Say no more. And reason number three, well, two words. Artificial intelligence. Hello, Anthony Fennell here. Now, let's pick up on that last point. Exactly 3 years ago, ChatGPT arrived on the international scene. And for teachers and lecturers, it really caused a quandary.
Straight after the launch of ChatGPT, there was a huge panic in schools and universities. Schools in particular were panicking a lot about how students would be cheating, using Gen AI to do their homework. I think that has died down over the last 2 years. And I think schools pretty much over kind of policing student use of the Gen AI. Schools are a lot more controlled places. They have very fixed curricula, very fixed ways of doing things. And a lot of the teaching and learning is very procedural. I mean, particularly in primary schools, the further up the education system you go, the more students are meant to work for themselves, to work independently, to do quite complex things, and are very much independent learners. And I think that's where Gen AI really has come in, because the promise of, you know, ChatGPT writing your essay for you has obvious appeal. And also in higher education, students are under a lot more pressure in terms of time. They may be having one or two extra jobs. University may not be the main thing they're doing. So, you know, students at higher education are always looking for shortcuts and are more able to use them.
Neil Selwyn from the School of Education, Culture and Society at Monash University. So, universities and AI. That's our focus today. Welcome to Future Tense on ABC Radio National.
I think universities are making some good strides with generative AI tools, but I think there's still a fundamental question of how are we going to know what people can do when they can just get AI to do so much for them. I'm Philip Dawson. I'm a professor and the co-director of the Centre for Research in Assessment and Digital Learning, or CRADL, at Deakin University. I think there's a big challenge between, do we allow students a lot of use of AI, which will enable us to see what they can do in this world where AI is definitely going to be there when they graduate. But if we do that, how do we know what they personally can do? How do we kind of disentangle what's the machine and what's the person?
So the assessment problem for universities with AI is a really difficult problem. And then on top of that, of course, you've got AI systems not being static. They're changing all the time. So in one sense, is there almost like an arms race to try and keep up to date with the changes that are going on?
So people might have heard of this thing called a Turing test, which is this idea of let's build some sort of AI machine that's indistinguishable from a human. One of these Turing tests is called the Robot College Student Turing Test, and it's a stated, explicit aim of the field of AI going back decades to be able to build an AI that can, on its own, get a degree. That mission that they've been on for decades is completely incompatible with sort of our idea of trying to assess people and be sure we're just giving the degree to a person.
And the impact of all of this on educators themselves?
We've spoken to educators who have said, look, I'm just going to quit. This is too hard. I don't want to have keeping up with the latest AI developments as part of my job. I'm out. In some of our work, we've advocated for almost the right to get it wrong. We've put university educators in an impossible situation to come up with a perfect solution. What we need are just a bunch of different good enough approaches, try things out. They're not going to work perfectly, and institutions have to be okay with that.
there's an increasing split between faculty who are becoming increasingly concerned or resistant to AI. There's been a few open letters circulating around online where university professors are signing up to say, we want no uncritical use of generative AI in the university. The university is not a place to be doing this. So there's growing resistance that we're seeing over the past few months. But then on the flip side, there's lots of university staff who are becoming increasingly enthusiastic about what AI can do for them and can do for their students as well. So we've got professors and tutors using AI for quite menial routine things, you know, lesson planning, coming up with some classroom content, structuring lectures. We do have some lecturers who are using it for writing feedback and assessing and grading. And then there are some more creative uses as well. So I think at the moment we are seeing a huge spectrum of people who are either violently against it, very for it, and lots of people in the middle who are, you know, this generative AI is just popping up in all of the things that we do now. When you turn on a learning management system or a word processor, something will pop up and say, do you want AI to help you? And often people are just clicking yes. If it's something they feel that's not super crucial to what they're doing, if it's writing an email or drafting a message. Yeah, so it's interesting. It's a mixed economy.
Is there a split according to departments? Are certain departments, certain fields of study, are they more likely to embrace artificial intelligence?
From what I can see, and particularly looking at lecturers talking to each other online, no. And there's actually quite a lot of interest in the computer sciences for making less use of generative AI. So you'd think, you know, the STEM subjects, the science, the technology, engineering and maths might be more for it. There is some pushback from tutors in those areas, and often because they're finding the limitations of generative AI. There was lots of hype that generative AI could, you know, do coding for everybody and we would no longer need to learn. And the computer science lecturers are saying, no, this technology is actually quite dangerous. If students use this to try and support their coding activities, we don't want this in our classrooms. So I don't think there's a split necessarily in terms of subject area. And there's not really much difference in terms of age as well. I mean, lots of young academics, lots of young tutors and lecturers can see the limitations of this. There are many older professors that can think this thing is great. So it's interesting. There doesn't seem to be a kind of split along the usual lines you'd imagine. Who knows how that's going to pan out in the future, but for the time being, it's undecided.
There's a lot of institutions that are doing a big lurch back to face-to-face exams. That's probably one of the most common responses to this problem. And that's because, you know, if I get you to sit there and I've done some sort of screening on you as you come through the door, I can be somewhat confident that you aren't using AI in ways I don't want you to. Now, I'm someone who did a computer science degree that was pretty much all pen and paper exams, and that's a pretty useless way to assess whether someone could program a computer, getting them to sit in a room and write pen on paper. So there's problems with that shift back. One of the other dominant approaches is a rise in what we call interactive oral assessment, sitting down, having a chat with people about their work. So you might get someone to go out and do a big project, and then get them to come in and talk with you about the project, ask them some hard questions, ask them why they made particular choices, what it would be like if they did something else. Those are probably the dominant things.
Some universities are applying what are called student declarations, that the student has to declare that they haven't used AI or they used AI in a way that the university accepts. How effective do you feel those kind of declarations can be?
Any approach to sort of addressing assessment and AI that relies on students voluntarily saying, hey, I've used AI, I think is a bit doomed to failure. These approaches don't have any teeth because there's not really a way to know if the student's been honest or not. And there's incentives for the student to not be honest in the AI use declarations. I was part of a study led by Jess Luo from the Education University of Hong Kong that looked at teachers marking student work that they thought might have been AI generated that the student had submitted. And the teachers judged the student work more harshly and marked it down for reasons that weren't really anything to do with the learning outcomes that were being assessed. It was just they felt kind of negative towards AI. So I worry that students who say, yes, I used AI in the declaration are putting themselves at a disadvantage, while at the same time, there being no benefit to the institution in terms of knowing for sure if students have used AI.
The University of Leeds, as I understand it, has what's called a traffic light approach. How does that work?
So traffic light approaches say for a given assessment task, we are going to let you use AI in these ways, but not those ways. So it might be, you know, a green traffic light might say, use AI all you want, and a red traffic light might say, don't use it at all. And the amber light is some sort of, you can use it a bit, but not entirely, you know, but you've got to produce the final product. The problem is allowing some use of AI is allowing all use of AI. Unless you're in there really watching what someone does, you can't be sure whether they've used AI or not or to what extent. So these sort of traffic light approaches are kind of worse than doing nothing at all because they give us sort of an illusion of enforcement. They make us think we've addressed the problem when the problem is still entirely there.
And at best, you can imagine, it just builds ambiguity into the system.
Yeah, absolutely. And it creates a situation where some students who are obsessive rule followers are going to do the right thing, but a lot of other people are just going to go, well, we all know this is just a bit of theatre, so I'm going to do what I want.
Out of interest, are any universities banning the entire use of AI, or have we moved past that point?
There's been talk about banning the use of AI, and early on in the piece, some institutions banned the use of AI entirely, and some school systems did the same thing. But to my knowledge, most of them have walked away from it. It's a fundamentally unenforceable thing, unless you're going to observe absolutely every moment of assessment across an entire degree, which is cost prohibitive, but also a really bad experience for students, and it won't prepare them for a world where AI is there.
So in many ways, the process of trying to maintain the traditional means of student assessment and then factor in AI is a wicked problem. But some institutions and educators, as Professor Dawson has suggested, are questioning why the old ways have to be preserved at all. Rupert Wagerif is with the Digital Education Futures Initiative at the University of Cambridge, and he argues that a focus on teaching critical thinking should be paramount. Critical thinking, he says, is essentially dialogue. And so the best way to teach a student how to think is to engage them in dialogue.
One of the things we found empirically, for example, is that if you get young primary kids, about 8, 9, 10, to talk together effectively around reasoning tests, they will individually improve their ability to solve reasoning tests. And it was fairly clear that what was going on was that they were internalizing the dialogue. So they had a kind of voice in their head saying, you know, why do you think that? Have you considered the alternatives? They internalized this after engaging in dialogue with others. So the idea is that our internal, shall we say, higher order thinking, the reflective thinking that we are looking for when we're trying to teach critical thinking, for example, is an internalized dialogue. In other words, there has to be some kind of tension between different perspectives that motivate reflection and creative insights.
You're very positive about the potential of generative AI to help people think more effectively. Explain your reasoning. What is it about AI that you think has this power or this potential?
Well, it's partly from personal experience. I'm a professor at Cambridge, and yet my dialogues with AI are expanding my range of insight into different issues. So it seems to me obviously has great potential. And then when I compare that with all the accounts I read of how it's dumbing people down, I think that's interesting, but that's not necessarily indicative of the potential of AI. That's indicative of the way in which people are using it to fit into a pre-existing system. Obviously, if students have to get marks to succeed and the AI can do it better than them, they're going to rely on the AI, and rather obviously, that'll mean that they don't develop the skills for themselves. So clearly, what we need to do is motivate students to have passions, to have interests, to have curiosity. And when they have that motivation, the AI is, I was going to say a servant for a minute. That's obviously the wrong, well, I don't know. It just sounds like a dodgy word, doesn't it? But clearly, the AI is their assistant, helping them to achieve their learning goals. So I find that quite exciting because it implies that we really have to shift our emphasis in education away from teaching students a preset menu of things that other people have already discovered and towards encouraging them to think and learn for themselves. Now, I'm not for a minute suggesting that we can abandon all that knowledge. I just think that the AI will force us to promote students' interests and engagement in learning.
The arrival of generative AI has made many educational institutions start to question the essay or the written assignment as a measure of learning. Your thoughts about that? Is that a good thing?
Yes. I've noticed certainly here at Cambridge, for example, people seem to imagine that writing a cunningly crafted essay that compares and contrasts and comes up with a personal synthesis is somehow the essence of good thinking. I suspect that it's probably more like a reflection of their particular cultural background and tradition. They all learned how to write essays in schools and so on. And essays are, you know, a beautiful piece of cultural artifact sometimes, but it's not the only way to demonstrate that you're thinking. Plenty of more oral cultures and indeed oral people who use language for dialogue and reflection can think extremely well without knowing really how to craft a Cambridge essay. So I think a lot of what we've been teaching, with the pretense that we're teaching some kind of universal thinking skill, has just been a particular cultural tradition. And I think the AI punctures some of those assumptions and challenges us to look at the reality of good thinking beyond that particular Oxbridge-type framing.
So does that mean a return to oral traditions of learning, the type of thing that existed in the past before we became so focused on writing and the printed document?
Well, I think it probably does. And obviously, it's not a simple return, you know, you might call a return at a higher level, because clearly we can now build on all the amazing achievements of print-based education, the fact that we have this global cumulative body of knowledge that we call science, for example. We're not trying to abandon that, but the focus on the written medium as a medium, a focus of education and a focus of developing thinking, has particular affordances that are perhaps a bit narrow, and we shouldn't ignore the tremendous affordance for thinking of real oral face-to-face dialogues. So in oral traditions, you have this more embodied, more situated, more holistic approach where you have to really listen and respond to a range of different perspectives. And I think the AI can help us to return to what I would say is that deeper understanding of intelligence, of real embodied intelligence that solves real-world problems. And real-world problems are always quite complex. They're not just the sort of things that you can learn about through books entirely. And so, I find that quite exciting.
Given what you said about dialogue, the importance of dialogue, how do you make assessments on that? How do you introduce that kind of learning into an educational system?
Well, did you know that, for example, in a university like Cambridge, where I'm speaking from, until quite recently, last couple of hundred years, all assessments were oral. Written assessments replaced the oral viva voces. Well, we still have viva voces for PhDs. The reason why we can't have oral assessment in all areas is because it's kind of time consuming and people think it's not very standardized. But now I see a tremendous potential for AI chatbots to bring back that kind of oral assessment. I think a relatively short and friendly chat with a particular bot, and we haven't developed them yet, but I am working on this with a range of partners, this idea, taking it forward, could tell you what your level of knowledge was in mathematics, in history, in any area, in a way that was not quite so fraught as the standardized test, and that was more accurate and more standardized. So I wonder if we might not return to this tradition of oral assessments that we abandoned only, you know, relatively recently, but using the technology to do that.
And you're with Future Tense, an ABC Radio National production. I'm Anthony Fennell. At Monash University in Melbourne, the Centre for Learning Analytics is led by Professor Dragan Garcevic, and Professor Garcevic sees an opportunity for generative AI to play a role in promoting greater equity.
So AI has some promise to be used to provide personalized tutoring. AI has lots of promise actually to increase access of different resources to students with special needs or across the globe as well, with different linguistic needs as well. So, for example, students who have some particular needs, for example, dyslexic students, we can actually assist them to get a gist of the information they were supposed to read, but they may have trouble reading.
But for students without special needs, says Professor Garcevic, AI can be problematic. It can promote overconfidence.
For the student, it is becoming hard because they often get a bit under the impression that they know something or they don't need to know something. For example, computer programming, that many students who enter into the first programming courses, they often wonder, why do I need to now learn all these things when AI can do them? And secondly, also all my future employers can, and they do have expectation that I use AI effectively. But then that is, AI is really good at some very basic things and particular types of performance. Yet the moment they have to work on more complex types of tasks, they hit a really big, hard brick wall. And in that case, they really need to then realize, oh, I need to learn and develop my basic expertise before I can become a really good pilot of my AI that is the co-pilot in this particular case. So that's one thing. And for the educators, it's also quite hard to observe how students got to the answers or created certain products like essays or short answers or computer code or you name it. So many universities are trying to go to the old-fashioned exams that are proctored. Others are trying to also introduce the oral exams. My view is that these ideas are fine, not necessarily particularly scalable, and also they are still not emphasizing the process of how people are interacting with AI and how they can improve their learning. And that's where we actually can, again, leverage AI to mitigate the problems that AI brings. In other words, that students' interactions with AI systems can be recorded. These are generating large amounts of data. That data can be used then to assess both the product and the process that students are creating. And to do that, AI's potentially useful help to the educators to inform their assessment decisions.
But I would imagine that's a lot of extra work, isn't it, for those educators, for those tutors, for those lecturers, on top of the work they're already carrying out.
It's a really difficult thing, especially in the current setup. There's lots of pressure on them to execute some of these things. We don't still have the technology that can support educators in such a way that they can really more organically help the learners to understand their learning processes and also for them to inform their future assessments. So that's something that I think it's a big open challenge, but also something that I would really like to see much more investment, because we in research are already seeing lots of evidence. When we are creating assessments that are accounting the data about students, not only products, but also about their processes, we are getting far more reliable assessments. Based on our existing research, we also have one particular emphasis, and that only those who know particular subject or particular domain benefit the most from AI. In other words, that synergy between AI and human skills only happens at a high level of human skills as well. So we must not underestimate the importance of the development of some of these capabilities that we were already emphasizing in the domain and the broader education system, except that we, in this specific situation, we also now need to see how these synergies are happening. So that's, to me, one of the greatest challenges that the broader education system is tackling days. So I want to emphasize one more thing here, is that many education departments and also broader community, not just the Australian, but across the world is as well, that we don't necessarily have sufficiently big amounts of good quality of evidence about these best practices, how to incorporate AI into the teaching and learning. And we also have some of the evidence that is really conflating the point I previously mentioned, that's the learning and performance. So, for example, some of these aggregations of the studies are showing like students' academic performance increases with the use of generative AI. And when we dig deeper into some of these studies, it shows that students are increasing the quality of the translation, for example, from one language to another language when they're using generative AI. But it's not indicative of the learning. And so that's really the big thing that we need to pay attention to in the decision making.
One of the big imperatives that we've been told for the past 3 years is we need to have AI in universities and schools because of jobs. We need to prepare students for the workplaces of the future. And it's an unpopular opinion perhaps now, but you could argue education's not just about preparing students for jobs. It's the opposite. Employers can prepare students for the jobs that they have to do. You could argue that the role of the university is more than that. And it's interesting, the hype around AI and jobs is ever changing. So we were told, I don't know, 5 years ago, we needed to teach all our students how to code. Everyone needed to be a coder. A couple of years ago, we were told generative AI can now code. Everyone now needs to be a prompt engineer. It changes all the time. Now we're being told, you know, generative AI doesn't really work. We need new forms of AI that don't need prompting. And it is this never-ending hype and never really fully realized hype around, you know, imperatives for preparing students for the workplace. So in some ways, I think what we are working out through this kind of generative AI hype cycle is that really, I think the role of universities is to help students learn to do things, give them real expertise. For sure, there's a need for universities to also prepare them how to do that thing with AI. There's this whole idea of augmented working. You'll be working alongside some forms of AI. But we also really do need to help students know when to work around or work against or take control of what's going on. And that's where the critical thinking skills really come in. And so I think what students are asking for, and actually what employers are increasingly saying they want as well, are students that can think for themselves, have critical thinking skills, that can work together, can collaborate, creative skills, communication, all the things that universities have been teaching for decades. Giving students AI job-ready skills, I don't think is A, possible, or B, the role of the university necessarily.
There's a lot of focus in public discussion and debate on what students learn, you know, on the content. Correct me if I'm wrong, but there doesn't seem to be the same attention paid to how students can learn to learn, if you like, the art of actually learning. Why is that, do you think?
That is a really interesting point and a really important point. In some ways, a lot of the debates around AI and the future of the school or the university are not really much to do with the AI. They're about the state that our education system's in. And we've had 2 or 3 or 4 decades of reform in schools and universities that are very much based around students having to learn stuff. And as you say, it's more about the output and the outcome rather than the process. And in some ways, that's where generative AI falls down, because generative AI promises you the output and the outcome and says, well, we'll take care of the process. And the process is all about the learning. The learning is all about the hard work, the time it takes, you know, people failing to do stuff. That's where most people who are experts in learning say that learning really, really takes place. And so in some ways, the debates around generative AI reflect that we've got a system now that perhaps is more focused on the output and the outcome and is less worried about the process. And we've had, as I say, decades of reforms that are very much around things about standardization of what is taught and how it's taught. You know, this emphasis on efficiency, effectiveness, scores, metrics, league tables. So it's a system where everyone is just trying to get the work done, giving people grades and getting them through the systems. And that's not about learning. That's not what learning is all about at all. And so the promise of AI taking care of the process fits really well into this kind of more broken model of education. And you could argue we need to rethink our schools and universities so they have much more emphasis on the, as you say, learning to learn, the process of learning, rather than being focused on the product and the grade. But that's such an unfashionable way to think about learning these days that there's a much bigger debate to be had there about, you know, rethinking our education system. But I agree with you. The whole point of learning is it's hard work. There's going to be friction. It's going to take time. You're going to get things wrong. You learn through failing. Learning is meant to be all of those difficult things, and the promise of generative AIs will get rid of the difficulty. And that is a real worry.
Neil Selwyn, who specialises in the integration of digital tools into education and learning. We also heard today from Monash University's Dragan Garcevic, Rupert Wagerif at Cambridge, and Philip Dawson from the Centre for Research and Assessment and Digital Learning at Deakin University. Karin Savanovitz is my Future Tense colleague and co-producer. I'm Anthony Fennell. Until next time, cheers.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.